This is part of a discussion led by Edwin G. Norris, former chairman of the President's Committee of Economic Advisors, on a stable economy in an unstable world. Under the chairmanship of Provost Donald W. Gilbert, the discussion will be led off with the question, in an uncertain world of economic revolution, struggle, and upheaval, what may we do to sustain a stable economy for ourselves and for our global neighbors?
I think that the probable usefulness in time of war has led to considerable abuse of the principle of public aid there. I'd rather go back to more private enterprise in that, along with the various fields of communication and transportation.
Well, do you feel that in the time of crisis, for example, in the aircraft industry, that if it is necessary to subsidize to the government, these corporations, do you feel that the government should be in control during the period of that advancement of money and then to relinquish its control when the private enterprise gets on its feet in that particular field?
Well, I'm hesitant of that. You have to have a certain amount of control, but the tendency to say because there's an element of subsidy, we take a pretty complete direction, and I think is slipping over into a dangerous area.
May I ask whether you people out there can hear a question when it's asked here and vice versa? Do we need to speak a little louder? Can you hear all right out there? Anything? Question out there.
Would you comment on the recent increase in steel prices in U.S. Steel just made, given the reason the pensions are granted for labor?
Sure. Well, I skirted discreetly up toward that area. Now, in the bosom of the family, I think it's only fair to me, to you, for me to say just what my thought is in that area. And I've argued this out with Mr. Voorhees, both when I had him come down to Washington to discuss a previous steel raise, and when he congratulated me on my courageous stand in resigning and invited me to come in and talk to him, and I went in and talked to him and told him how unwise I thought the course that they were following at that time. I hope I justified his faith in my courage. I just don't think that it constitutes a good exemplification of the private enterprise system when a corporation, which is in the leadership position in a basic industry of that sort, goes ahead and raises its salary of its executives in the midst of strained wage negotiations and insists on a non-contributory principle for large executive officer pensions, and that it's wicked and stupid to have a non-contributory principle for workers' pension schemes, and then goes on and in the first place calls a strike. And I was utterly amazed. What he wanted me to come in and talk about was if I could give him a tip-off as to whether the government would take steps if they held out until this got to a strike. And here is the amazing thing. Now, this is not for general repetition, but it is true that quite regardless of what my judgment was as to how far they were going, he had it pretty clear in his own mind that if they held out, the government would find some means of intervening. And in his logic, intervention would lead on. You'd never retrace the steps, that you've got a sort of a ratchet mechanism there. And it would go on until it would be the commitment which would lead to nationalization of the steel industry. And yet he was going to hold out in their negotiations there at the expense of a strike, in their total situation of earnings and so on, been fully further revealed since that time, rather than make the best collective bargaining settlement that he could make. at that time. Now that just seems to me a stultification of the principle of venture capitalism following collective bargaining in good faith to seek economic adjustments. Now what happened was it went on to the strike situation, which cost them millions, I think hundreds of millions of dollars, the cost of that strike in the steel industry, to come to a settlement, which was as bad from their point of view, and no more good from the standpoint of the unions than they would have got through collective bargaining. I think that they could have come to that at that time. Now, when they get to that point, immediately he raises, takes the leadership in the raising of the price of steel on the theory that in spite of their earnings position, which is satisfactory now, it won't be that satisfactory when they get down to a 60% basis or something, that you can't. In other words, the logic of it is that you have to average the next big depression into the present prosperity period as the basis of pricing, which brings your prices up to the point that the market cannot absorb within its income structure steel and steel fabricated products on that basis. And thus, by preparing your company for the depression, you bring the depression to pass. The better you prepare yourself, the deeper the depression. I say that that's my analysis of that steel price raise at this time on the basis of such knowledge as I have. Now, he would immediately say, well, Dr. Norse just hasn't seen these facts and figures and so on. He came down to our council table there, and he said, well, I'm not going to give you anything but facts. There's no theory about this thing. He says, I'll just tell you the facts. He was reared as an accountant. He came up to the chairmanship of the Finance Committee of U.S. Steel from the accountant approach. And so he started with all these assumptions. He made his cost figures, which showed that price must be raised by that particular amount. And then I said, well, Mr. Voorhees, we appreciate your coming here, and we're very much impressed by this management by this analysis from the management point of view with a certain set of assumptions. Now, will you bear with me when I put myself in the position of the chief executive of the nation asking the question of what will be the impact of that sort of a thing on the economy? If it's good as a protective device for you in the short run, what will it be for the country as a whole? And that's the thing which just seems to me he didn't accept at that time, and he hasn't accepted yet. But it is the thing which makes difficult, and the will and one hope I see on that is that as the the other steel companies will follow a competitive practice and not follow price leadership, which is the bane of that situation now. Because if you have, in my judgment, bad economic statesmanship in the leadership company and the leadership principle is followed, then they can easily go on to the point where they do bring nationalization on themselves. But when I say what private enterprise has to offer, I say I think it has something better than nationalization, and that would be very much better than what they're actually doing at the present time as I understand it.
If there are any members of the press here, I hope they will respect Dr. Norse's confidences. We're enjoying the confidences. We'd hate to have them broken.
Well, that's what puts me into it, and I didn't think of any press person being here.
I don't think there are any. There's a question here.
Dr. Norse, when you speak of competitive enterprise, do you include, how do you take into account our tariff system? And do we have a competitive enterprise when we do build up a tariff wall?
Well, we have several mitigations of competitive situation, and that's a very pertinent question to raise, because we are going to be faced now, if we are going to bring the non-Soviet world into a healthy and constructive situation, there's got to be a maxim of workable freedom of trade, and I'm very much afraid of a recrudescence of protectionism, which would simply wall off that kind of competition, which I think is necessary. And we have within the domestic scene other things which are attempts to do it. Your price maintenance laws, joint tidings and the rest, state as well as federal legislation there, is attempt to prevent the competitive process from working.
Yes, but can we be willing, or are we willing as a nation, do you think, to perhaps lower our standard of living? Well, consider that the case that this fellow brought up about the Waltham Watch Company that claims they've been...
No, I don't think you lower your standard of living. I think you raise your standard of living, because without that you are choking off production in the various areas. If you face competition, sure, somebody's ox is gored in the process. And that's the point. If everybody insists that he must be protected, that you're going to make an omelet without breaking eggs... Might carry it to the absurd and say, if every egg could say, yes, we're sure you can have omelets, but you mustn't break me.
Dr. Norris, this afternoon you spoke of the three areas of the American economy: management, labor, and agriculture. Do you equate capital with management, and where does capital fit into the picture?
Well, the implication of what you say is quite right, is to say that these three are not comparable. Agriculture is labor and capital in a kind of organization, industry which is organized in a different way. It's been traditional to say capital and labor as representing, take the industrial area, and making a dichotomy between capital and labor. But there's an ambiguity crept in there by reason of the fact that the owners of labor, of capital, do not any longer administer their capital. It goes through a roundabout process, and so it is the professional managers of industry who are the ones with whom organized labor deals. So I think that those are the terms to use, and they are not administered, they are not the spokesman for capital as the capitalists would speak for themselves, which was the assumption of all our classical reasoning. I don't think that we economists have ever found a satisfactory form of exposition to describe what's going on there, but until a proper definition comes along, I'll have to trail along with management versus labor rather than capital versus labor.
Sorry,
can
we
talk
about the hot potato now?
And,
I think it is one of the most important questions of the present situation, and that is that we all know we're spending too much, the federal government spending, that is, and the burning question is, where shall we cut? And it's like the question of the eggs again. Well, fine, we'll get rid of one egg out of the basket,
yeah.
Not me.
Well, I'd give you, I guess, a sort of come to about a three-part answer to that. In the first place, I take my position, and not all economists are with me on this, to say that getting back from the acceptance of what I called in a certain notorious speech, slipping into deficits as a way of life, I think that is dangerous. There are economists who don't. Say we can go on with the increase we owe it to ourselves, and the $1 trillion debt is no more scaring than this is. We were scared when it went from 26 to 43, and when it went to 43 above 100, we knew we'd be lost, and now it's gone to 259, and we still are all right. So like the little girl with her prayer, she didn't say them last night or the night before, and the devil didn't get her, so she didn't go to say them anymore. I'm scared of ye old boy. And Now, what are you going to do about it? What's your practical answer when you're in this situation? In the first place, I don't go, yeah, I don't think so. I think that the only intelligent fiscal policy at the present time recognizes the balance over the ups and downs of business. I don't want to use the word cycle in that connection, but over the whole period, the provident look ahead that that is the way to do it. Well, now, what situation are we in now? Why do I object to this? Because we are having deficits at the prosperity end of the cycle. I said we'll drop back into that, but they're projecting deficits of $5.5 to perhaps $7 billion a year on the assumption of a plateau formation, the maintenance of high production. Now, the only partial justification of that is that we are in the situation of a Cold War, so you don't have the ordinary business considerations. Still, I think we are weakening our possibility of continuing to fight a Cold War and possibly having to take the stretch which would come if the war got hung. We're doing that more by piling up, by raising the national debt above this level at this time, would be bringing it down. Now, your next proposition is that if you go in with a meat axe and try to make a rectification of $5 or $10 billion at one fell swoop, you have to recognize that of the $45 billion that the government is spending, every dollar of that goes either to pay someone on the federal payroll or to have federal procurement of goods, contracts that are come from industry or stuff bought from the farmer, what it may be. And what goes to the individual as payroll then is spent for cars and houses and all the rest. So you can't simply pull back on that thing and still maintain an employment economy around the $60 million level. You've got to make your switch over into private sources of expenditure. So what I think the practical thing is to hold below, not accept the idea of piling $5 billion on in these years, but getting down to the lowest practical point that you can in 1 year without so sudden a contraction that your nose over. All right. What's your program? Well, I don't think that the extreme programs of NAM or Harry Byrd or even the recent CED one are quite realistic. I think the closest approach to realism is that Senator Paul Douglas has put up. Now, I may be prejudiced because he, like myself, is a past president of the American Economic Association. I think his logic is better than that of some of these other people. He has a list of seven things which would include not the $130 million increase of postal charges to reduce that deficit, but the whole thing of over $500 million. You bring it up. And just to show how he goes at it, he and the American Economic Association were talking about that. He went on and said, I think perhaps that some subsidy for the dissemination of educational matter through the mails is justifiable. But I don't see any reason why the public should subsidize the dissemination of advertising through the mail. I think business should pay its own bill. And he said the largest item of that, of course, He said the largest item of that, of course, is the mail order catalog, and I think that that should pay its own way. And I say this in spite of the fact that the two largest mail order houses in the country are both constituents of mine in Illinois. Well, now, you've got to go at it that way and make various services, which business and other people are perfectly ready to accept, including the cutting down of the subsidy on the farmer. Then he, in his seven-point program, another very important area is in the elimination of waste, of outright waste in personnel. And a very large factor there, he goes down and points out, for instance, that the federal payroll, that the federal payment gets only 2/3 of a year's work for each person employed. When you add the annual leave, which was set on the basis of a 6-day week and the same number of days continued on a 5-day week, and when you add on the increasing sickness allowances and various things and the holidays and so on, he goes through it step by step. He says, we're getting 2/3 of a year's work, and I think that now that we've raised the rates on that, we should get a year's work for it. And there are a large number of supernumerary employees, and so he would freeze the increase in a department so that they would simply absorb their saving by the death and resignation of persons in the department. And then, of course, the military is the largest area. And there, I think, the most progress has been made. And I think we want to give Mr. Truman credit on that. I saw the struggles through which they went to bring that military aid program down, to hold it first to the 15 million when the services were screaming for 30. And I mean screaming. And they had gone through the whole elaborate work of a complete defense budget with all the details worked out on the $30 billion basis when the president had told them that 15 billion would be the limit. And Mr. Webb was like Senator Douglas is the kind of public servant who can do this. He got called the secretaries in, and he said, when the president told you 15 and you go through all this, use the paid labor of your departments to build up that elaborate budget, he says, I think it's pretty poor staff work. And after that lecture, they came back with one which showed that $23 billion was the very lowest they possibly could live on. They had to go around the circle a third time before they got down to 17 and a half. And the president said 15 is still 1-5, period. And I think that issue, well, I know it because Secretary Johnson tossed it across the table in my teeth, that the president, I think, stood to the $13 billion limit in the ceilings of the budget of 51, which has just gone in. And Secretary Johnson, I think, came in on a promise that he would carry that thing out. I think that I wasn't there when it was said, but I feel perfectly confident that the president said, yes, Louis, you can have the defense secretaryship if you accept that $13 billion and get the expenditures down to it. And Mr. Johnson did just exactly that. Now, there are places, then there's, of course, the Hoover Plan, you take all those things, I think it would be practical, even within the limitations of our congressional procedure, I think it would be practical to prune $2, $3, $4 billion out, something of that sort. I don't know just what it would come to. I don't think it would either be possible or wise to prune 5, 6, or 7 out at one step, but make it a 3-year program, such as be in the black in 52.
How can you keep pruning out like that when the senators and representatives are up for election every year and they have to take care of the people in their constituency, the veterans and everybody that are wanting, if they give them money?
Well, of course, that's the question of our political system, whether we can make it work, whether they do have to or just think they have to. Now, in this particular instance, there was a case. I used to twit my friends at the Chamber of Commerce just up half the street, half a block from Brookings, a block from the Executive Officers Building. I used to say, sure, you people holler for economy, but I said, just as soon as they start to put a little economy into the budget, your state chamber and every local chamber is in here saying, sure, but not us. It's the same, the egg was talking back again. I said this to Herman Steinkraus, the new president of the Chamber of Commerce, and he said, that's changed. No, he said, have you seen my letter about the Johnson movement? I said, no. He says, I'll send you one. What was it? When Mr. Johnson announced that program of an immediate cut of 200,000 in personnel, when he said, I do not propose to have a peacetime WPA in the Department of Defense, he went in and announced these. the abandonment of unnecessary shore installations and of obsolete quartermaster depots and the sort of thing. That's the way you cut it down. If you're going after to save $1 billion, you've got to do some cutting. You've got to show some blood. So he did this, and Herman Steinkraus wrote the president and wrote Johnson saying the chamber has advocated an economy program. We are much gratified that this much economy has been put in, and we will support it, not undermine it. And then he sent a letter to every one of the 2,500 local chambers all over the country saying, you've asked for economy, well, here it is, don't foul it up. You do two things. First, to the negative, don't come to Washington and try to get your particular cut rescinded. And don't get on the telephone, and don't get on the Western Union. Accept it. And then the second one, the positive note. He said, what you do want to do is to find out just where those cuts are going to affect your community. Look ahead to see just how many people and what kind of people are going to be disemployed in that process of economy. And then get busy to see that every one of those that it's humanly possible is promptly reabsorbed in a productive job. Now there's the way you do it.
Right.
And it happened that I was addressing the day after I left office, I was addressing the Ohio State Chamber of Commerce, and I had a bit of this about Johnson in my manuscript. I sent it out there, and they immediately buzzed back to me and said, do you know what we have done in Ohio? Now, they were hit at Toledo and Akron with very substantial cuts, and they sent out the same sort of letter to all chambers there, and they got busy trying along just that line. A few states follow up that way, you do it.
Just shifting for a moment to the international scene, could you give us your views of point four?
Of what?
Point four, Truman's point four.
Well, I think that's an excellent, pious declaration. Now, we can't move very fast, and the appropriations, Bill Thorpe, who's the Assistant Secretary in charge of Economic Affairs, I think has designed a very moderate program to initiate pilot plant studies in these several countries and feel out what can be done. And the particular merit of that is to feel out channels through which private financing and private industrial development and private mercantile development can be fitted into those countries and what bars there are, and then try to lower them as much as possible. I don't think that the point four program necessitates a gigantic problem of public financing in those areas. In other words, passing from the Marshall Plan to a super Marshall Plan for all the other countries that haven't had theirs yet. But if it is, this kind of feeling out exploratory thing, facilitating the moving of private capital in, and then if private capital, if private enterprise offers what it may in that area, we have a complementary relationship with those countries. If we're going to make markets for things in which we have a special advantage in this country and need an excess market, then I think a great deal can be accomplished. And there are quite a few firms. I've talked with a number, Ford and General Electric, and Goodrich occurred to me right away. Now, they are taking the position that that they are not concerned about this problem of convertibility of profits or convertibility of assets. That they have plants abroad. In some cases, they're just picking those up and getting them back into production and content for as far as they see ahead to plow back earnings in those countries, to use them as much as possible and plow them back and simply build up their equity and see what happens 20 years from now. In some cases, they're stepping in to expand plant, build additional. And of course, one of the interesting ones is the Sears Roebuck one. And it may be a very quickening influence in those countries because you're going into countries where distributive margins are so wide
that the absorptive power of your market is restricted, and they're going to come in as a competitive factor there with a narrow margin basis, and they're going to put capital in, you think, particularly the Latin American countries, Mexico and South America. Very interesting development is this new Cerro Bolivar development in Venezuela for the of U.S. steel. Now they plan to put some $500 million in to developing that as a source of high grade, or as the Mesabi is playing out, they've got something which is as good as or better than Mesabi, the highest, the richest ore that's been found in quantity anywhere, in very large amounts. Now that's going to be a part of the 0.4 program. Perhaps Venezuela needs it rather less than some other countries, but the Lord put his mineral deposits where he saw fit, and we've got to bat the ball that's pitched to us. But there are others. I think. Territory which might be covered. I'm glad that you spoke of the Employment Act and of the Council of Economic Advisers. There's also, of course, the Joint Committee in connection with the thing. I think that that is a tremendously important piece of legislation. I don't know how much you people have in any of your classes followed the thing or are disposed. To the theme that we had today, I'm fond of saying when discussing it, that I think it is in the first place in line with our traditional views in this country, and yet not limited to our traditional positions and practices. That is to say, it is in line with our traditions in its emphasis on a free enterprise system. I always comment with pleasure on the fact that it doesn't just say free enterprise, it says free competitive enterprise. And the shortcomings of our enterprise system have been when we've had tendencies toward monopolization or concentration of power, concentration of corporate power, concentration of labor power, or, as I said this afternoon, of agrarian power, any of those things are the things which, in my judgment, threaten the success of that traditional system. A great many people, I think, make a mistake when they pay their respects or make their devotions to that private enterprise system to take too narrow a view of the public sector. Again, I'm very much disposed to say that it is traditional in this country to have a mixed system. We've always had a mixed system. We've always turned to community or state or, on occasion, federal activities. We've not relied exclusively. We've certainly never been a laissez-faire system. And the one thing which is distinctive of this act is that, along with the reiteration of the traditional position, it seems to me that it makes a stronger declaration in favor of aggressive and intelligent, underscored, use of public functions where, on reasonable examination of our needs and our facilities, we feel that we should resort to public enterprise rather than limiting ourselves to private enterprise. Now, I touched on that, just alluded to it, and I want to give you one or two illustrations there which may kick off a little toward further discussion here. We have always felt that the field of transportation and communication was a characteristically desirable area to use the public, a approach, the public form of organization. We had toll roads at the beginning. Most of our toll roads passed out, toll bridges and so forth. In recent times, when we have had, that was curious, that we thought we needed to resort to greater financial resources than came through private capital. And then, curiously enough, recently with the coming of the automobile, we found that the public enterprise somewhat faltered, and so we gigged back to private enterprise, and we put up bridges with a toll system on it. We never have been doctrinaire. We've mixed it as one or the other seemed to produce the results. A second, or carrying that illustration a little farther, I think that the private enterprise in the automobile industry has had the rapid development that it did because at the same time we undertook a pretty aggressive use of public enterprise. In other words, if we had not used our public means of organization to build a highway system and build it fast and go into debt and set up state highway commissions with a certain amount of concentration, which seemed perhaps, well, did seem rather ominous from the standpoint of the old township system of handling roads. If we hadn't done that, the automobile industry, the private automobile and truck and bus industry, had never been able to develop itself as it was. So there was a teaming up, a complementary working of the two agencies. I think the other perhaps outstanding illustration, we could use many of them, but perhaps the outstanding one at the moment is that in power development. And I'll give you just one illustration there. I was out last year, then as chairman of the council, to get a feel of the situation in the Northwest where the proposed Columbia Valley Authority was under very heated discussion, and still is for that matter, and that Seattle, they had arranged a quite elaborate system for educating me on the elaborate presentation of the case for a Columbia Valley Authority. And under the auspices of the Chamber of Commerce, they had an equally pretentious presentation of the case for the Columbia Valley Authority. Well, we went in there, and there were a number of public utility people from four or five states that were involved there, and they went on with loud objections to the intervention of public authority in the field of power development. And after they had run the changes on it pretty well, I said, gentlemen, how far does your argument go? Do you mean to say that you would have liked to have thought it desirable for this section of no coal and no petroleum if the government had remained out of the field of power development, if it had not gone into the field of power development in a very large way, Bonneville and everyone can't speak the most. I said, would you have been able to make your contribution to the war to furnish jobs which attracted people back here and which gave you the post-war development that you have had? Can you conceive private capital of envisaging that need of power development for the region as a segment of the nation and of having the resources and the venturesomeness to do it? Well, no. I couldn't see that for a minute. Now, the controversy there, and there are two controversies which grow out of that. One is there an economically pragmatic line at which that line of development seems clearly to demand public enterprise? Is there equally an economic pragmatic line
beyond which eclectic experience of ours, it's desirable to not to have the state go. That is the public authority. And the answer to that is, I think, that public enterprise was necessary to envisage that need and to mobilize the systematic development of it, up to, as they say there, power at the bus bar. That is to say, when you have developed hydroelectric power at a series of big dams there, then they want to sell it. The argument of the utilities is that the government should not go beyond that, but should sell it to private utilities. And at that point, the realm of private enterprise both has rights and has efficiencies. Now, the practice there has been for public enterprise, having gone to that part, to be so sure that they see how that power should be fed out over the section, that they want to go into the distributing end, not sell power at the bus bar, but first build high power transmission lines. Then it goes a step farther. They aren't quite content to turn it over to private enterprise at that point, and so they have gone to the point of building retail distribution lines into small sections, and even to the point of insisting on building into a section which had developed a sort of a county, a little more than a municipal power development, and was able to sell power to its patrons at less than the rate, which is low for most sections, but would be high for that section. And they wanted to go in and force them to discontinue this very efficient local operation so that they could complete that system of comprehensive development that they had. Now, that is one problem, I would say, rather arbitrarily, just for here as a basis of discussion. And my position is very definitely that it is a necessary and economical area for government to develop make your large, systematic, high-tension grid, and stopping at that point and leaving it to cooperatives and to private utilities to carry on the retail distribution and the actual sale handling on a public utility basis. Now, the other questions involved in that is, if you have a power development of that sort, it is not merely a power development, but it is the integrated sort of thing which has the prototype in the TVA, where you have power and navigation and flood control and soil conservation and wildlife. There are five of those things that have to be fitted together. And there has been conflict between state fish and game commissions and reclamation service in Washington and army engineers and so forth. So they say, if we're going to have a well integrated development of these five functions, you need a public authority to do it. And thus the proposal of the Columbia Valley Authority, taking lessons from the TVA, which I think has done a rather outstanding job, but making modifications to fit the local situation. But then, if you're going to do that, then you get over to the field of political science. And how are you going to handle it? Can you have, as they propose, the persons who run this thing and who have, admittedly, very great power, can you have local autonomy by having them selected by the governors of the five affected states, or chosen from a panel from the governors of the five affected states? Or are you going to have foreigners come in and administer the resources of this area? Now, frankly, when you get to that point, I think that whatever you may say about the effective organization of functions in the area, you come to that last political science and human personnel issue. If you have the governors do it,
you would have four Republican governors doing it under the present situation with results which you can perhaps not spell out fully, but can possibly make some rough guesses at. They may be very rough. Some I heard out there were rough. On the other hand, suppose you say that in order to carry this out as a federal development, you must have nomination by the president and confirmation by the Senate. Then you raise the question. Planning philosophy, which would dictate the selection of the persons, and what would be the whole play of political condition, the confirmation, or the sort of Lilienthal fight, which would tie the thing up at that point. Now you see, you have a lot of theoretical analyses leading to blocks where your political considerations come in. How we are going to work out this frontier between private and public enterprise. Well, perhaps that's enough to get down to a little more concrete cases than the generalities which I presented over in the auditorium.